Picture a drafting room in Southampton, England. It's 1935. The windows are fogged with cigarette smoke in the coal heat of an English winter, and there's a man bent over a drawing board who already knows he's dying. He doesn't tell most of them. He just keeps drawing. That man is Reginald Joseph Mitchell, and the thing taking shape under his pencil is going to become the most beautiful fighter airplane the world has ever seen. Some of you are already nodding, because you know exactly where I'm headed. This is Radio Hangar, I'm Taildragger, and this is The Hangar. Pull up a chair, today we're going to talk about the Supermarine Spitfire, but more than that, we're going to talk about the man who drew her, and the race he was running that had nothing to do with airspeed. Before we get into it, let me tell you who keeps the lights on around here. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up the ladder. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And if you've ever run your thumb over one of those, you know exactly what I mean. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, let's go back. R.J. Mitchell wasn't born into airplanes. He was born in 1905 terms of aviation, meaning he grew up right alongside the whole business. Born in 1895, up in Stoke-on-Trent, the pottery country. His first job wasn't drawing wings. It was an apprenticeship at a locomotive works, building steam engines. Think about that. The man learned his craft on cast iron and boilers and the brute mechanical honesty of a railway engine. And then he found airplanes, and he never looked back. By the time he was 25 years old, Mitchell was the chief designer at Supermarine, a little seaplane outfit down on the water at Southampton. Now here's where it gets interesting. Supermarine didn't build fighters, they built flying boats, ungainly, graceful, salt-crusted machines that took off and landed on the water. That was the business. But there was a race, the Schneider Trophy. If you don't know it, the Schneider was the fastest thing going in the 1920s, a contest for seaplanes, and it had become a matter of national pride. Britain, Italy, the United States, all pouring money and engineering into airplanes built to do exactly one thing. Go fast over water. Mitchell built the airplanes that won it, the Supermarine S6 and the US-6B, sleek low-wing racers with enormous engines and floats hung underneath. In 1931, one of Mitchell's racers set a world speed record of over 400 miles an hour. 400 miles an hour. In 1931. Off the water. Now why does that matter for our story? Because everything Mitchell learned chasing that trophy, the thin wings, the clean lines, the marriage of a monster engine to a slippery airframe, all of it went into what came next. The Schneider racers were the rough draft. The Spitfire was the masterpiece. But between the racer and the fighter, life handed Mitchell the cruelest possible deal. In 1933, at 38 years old, he was diagnosed with rectal cancer. He had surgery, it was brutal, the kind of operation that in those days left a man permanently changed, and the doctors told him, more or less, the clock is running now. We don't know how long. Most men would have gone home. Mitchell went back to the drawing board. His first crack at a fighter honestly wasn't much. It was a design called the Type 224 Gull Wings, fixed landing gear and big trousered fairings, an open cockpit. The Air Ministry looked at it and shrugged. It was clumsy, it was ordinary. It was everything the Spitfire would not be. And here's the part I love, because it's the part that separates a good engineer from a great one. Mitchell looked at his own airplane, the one he'd poured himself into, and he decided it wasn't good enough. He threw it out, started over. And this time, Supermarine paid for it themselves as a private venture, because they believed in the man. What came off the board next was the Type 300, and that's the airplane, you know? Let me try to paint her for you, because a Spitfire is not just a collection of numbers. She is a shape you feel in your chest. The wing. Oh, the wing. It's an ellipse. A perfect, sweeping, curving ellipse, thin as a knife where it needs to be, the leading edge easing back and the trailing edge easing forward until they meet at a rounded tip. There has never been a more graceful wing bolted to a fighting machine. And here's the thing the poets always miss. Mitchell didn't draw that ellipse because it was pretty. He drew it because it worked. An elliptical wing gives you the lowest possible drag for the lift you're making. That's just physics. But there was a second reason. And it's the practical genius of the man. That thin wing needed to carry 8 machine guns and the landing gear and still be thin enough to go fast. The ellipse let Mitchell spread the wing out wide enough to bury all of that inside while keeping it slim in cross-section, beauty and function welded together. The prettiest answer to a hard engineering question anybody ever found. Now put an engine in front of it. The Rolls-Royce Merlin, a V12, liquid-cooled, and when that thing lit off it didn't putter, it snarled. There's a sound a Merlin makes at full song that I cannot describe to you if you've never stood next to one. It's a hard, cracking, ripping roar, 12 cylinders and a supercharger and open exhaust stacks, and it gets down into your ribs and rattles them. Grown men have wept at air shows for no reason they can name, and it's the Merlin doing it every time. the prototype she carried, the serial number K5054, first flew in March of 1936, and the test pilot who took her up, a fellow named Mutt Summers, climbed down after that first flight and said, "Don't touch anything," meaning she was right out of the box. That almost never happens. An airplane that flies true on the first hop is a gift, and everybody at Supermarine knew they'd been handed one.
The name? Where'd the name come from?
There's a story, and I believe it because it's too good not to. The chairman of the parent company had a young daughter. He called a little Spitfire a spirited, fiery little thing. Somebody suggested it for the airplane. And Mitchell, the story goes, grumbled that it was, quote, the sort of bloody silly name they would give it. He wanted something else, but Spitfire stuck, and it turned out to be exactly right, didn't it? Now, here's the tragedy that sits underneath all of this. All the time, Mitchell was refining her, the cancer was coming back, he kept working. There are accounts of him going to the airfield to watch the test flights when he could barely stand. He wanted to see her fly. This was his airplane, his last and best answer to a lifetime of learning, and he was determined to see her go. He flew to Vienna and to a clinic in Germany looking for a cure that wasn't there. He came home. He kept his eye on the airplane as long as his body let him. And then on June 11th, June 1937, R.J. Mitchell died. He was 42 years old, 42. He never saw a Spitfire a shot in anger. He never saw one climb into a summer sky over the English Channel. He never knew the name Spitfire would come to mean survival to an entire nation. He died with the airplane still an infant, only a handful built, the great test still years away. Take a moment with that. The man drew the wing that would save his country, and he died before his country needed saving. The work didn't stop. A brilliant engineer named Joseph Smith took over as chief designer and carried the Spitfire forward. And carry it he did through mark after mark after mark. But the shape, the soul of the thing, that elliptical wing and those clean lines, that was Mitchell. That was the dying man at the drawing board. Now let's talk about what his airplane did.
Summer of 1940. The Battle of Britain. France has fallen. The British army has been chased off the beaches at Dunkirk and come home with nothing but the men, across the channel. The German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, is massing to break the Royal Air Force and clear the way for an invasion of England itself. And standing between that invasion and the whole free world is a thin line of young men in fighter airplanes, Hurricanes mostly, honest and rugged and never given their due, and Spitfires. Here's a distinction worth knowing, because pilots get this wrong all the time. The Hurricane was the workhorse of the Battle of Britain. There were more of them, and they shot down more of the enemy and they took the bombers. But the Spitfire, with that thin, fast wing, she was the one they sent up against the German fighters, the one that could turn and climb with a Messerschmitt and beat it. She was faster, she was tighter in a turn, and above all, she was the airplane that got into the newsreels and the newspapers and the imagination of a frightened country. Picture a young man, 19, maybe 20 years old, sitting in that narrow cockpit at a grass field in Kent. It's a warm August afternoon, he smells hot oil and glycol coolant, and the sharp bite of high-octane fuel and his own sweat. The airplane trembles around him with the idle of the Merlin. His mouth is dry. The telephone rings in the dispersal hut, and somebody shouts scramble, and he's running, and then he's strapped in, and the throttle's going forward, and that snarl is filling the whole world, and the grass is blurring under the wheels. And then he's up, wheels tucking away, climbing hard toward a sky full of 200 German airplanes, and he is one of the few. Winston Churchill gave them the name that stuck for all time. Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few. Those few were flying Mitchell's airplane.
She survived the whole war, which almost nothing does. Most fighters that started the war in 1939 were hopelessly obsolete by 1942. Not the Spitfire. That thin elliptical wing had so much promise built into it that they just kept feeding her bigger engines and she kept getting better. She started the war at around 1,000 horsepower and finished with better than 2,024 marks. Something like 20,000 of them built from the Battle of Britain all the way to jets on the horizon, and she was still competitive at the end. That's the mark of a design that was right in its bones. And they're still flying. That's what gets me, right now, today, at flying museums and warbird collections around the world. There are Spitfires in the air. Down at Duxford in England, the old Battle of Britain field, you can stand on the grass and watch one come around the pattern, and hear that Merlin, and for just a moment the years fall away, and it's 1940 all over again. There are outfits that will take you up in a two-seat Spitfire now, strap you in behind the pilot and let you feel it. The cost of that would have bought you a decent airplane of your own back when Avgas was cheap, and airspace was free, but I'll tell you what, I've never once heard a soul climb out of a Spitfire and say it wasn't worth every penny.
every single one of them comes down changed, and every one of them is riding on the work of a locomotive apprentice from the pottery country who taught himself to draw airplanes, chased a speed record across the water, and then, with the clock running out on his own life, sat down and drew a wing so right that we're still flying it 90 years later. He never knew. That's the thing I keep coming back to. Mitchell never knew what he'd done. He died thinking he'd built a nice little fighter for the Air Ministry. He never got to know that his elliptical wing would hang in the sky over England, in the summer his country needed it most, and hold.
That's aviation, friends. Sometimes you plant a seed and you never see the tree. You do the work as well as you can do it. You make it as right and as beautiful as you know how, and you trust that it'll matter after you're gone. Mitchell did his work right, and it mattered more than he ever dreamed. My thanks today to the Royal Air Force Museum and the historians at Supermarine and Rolls-Royce Heritage for keeping Mitchell's story and his airplane alive, on the ground and in the air. If you want to see the photographs and dig into the marks and the numbers yourself, come find us at radiohangar.com. So, the next time you hear a Merlin light off at a fly-in, and every hair on your arm stands up, and you can't quite say why, now you know, that's a dying man's masterpiece, still singing, I'm Taildragger. Keep 'em flying.